Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
G'day and welcome to the National Security Podcast and our special series on the Women in National Security Conference. I'm Gabrielle Knipe, here with you for the fifth but not final episode of the series. The conference came to an end on Thursday and you are probably worried where you're going to get your national security fix after this week. But don't worry, we've got you covered with an additional episode of the podcast coming out next week. I'll have more on that later. Today, we have an interview with Dr. Hung Lee Tu, a senior analyst at ASPE Defence and Strategy Program. But before that, we had a brief catch-up with Nicole Renvert, Associate Fellow of the German Council on Foreign Relations. She and Chris had a chat about Germany's geopolitical trade and resource challenges. Let's take a listen.
Dr. Nicole Renvert, Associate Fellow of the German Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Now, you were on a panel yesterday that was discussing the Indo-Pacific. The Indo-Pacific is a fairly new concept. And is it that? Is it a concept? Is it a geographical concept? Is it a strategy? How should we think about the Indo-Pacific?
Well, you know, I tried to explain yesterday that the discussion about if it's called Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific is not really taking place in Europe. The reason behind it is that Europe, and particular Germany, see themselves as economic actors in the region, and their relationship towards India and China is the most important because this is where the markets are. From a security perspective, the Indo-Pacific concept is strikingly interesting because it makes policymakers think about how they view the power situation in this region. And this is something on the long run which will also affect European thinking on how to deal with India as a rising power, China's ambitions in the region, and our partners here, Australia, Indonesia, the ASEAN states. So in order to move from a purely academic concept, which the Indo-Pacific concept is, into policy making, we have seen that the Australian government used it already in its policy papers. But again, we have to understand that it's, at the end of the day, not about wording, but it's about policy being implemented. And again, how we deal with the power shifts in the region.
Yeah, and we've heard just from another lady who is from the Australian government that Australia's economic connection with Germany is very strong. We also see countries like the UK and France becoming quite heavily involved in the geopolitical landscape in the Indo-Pacific, and some of that is via military. How do we expect Germany to view its economic linkages to this region and how that relates to the security of the region as well?
Well, at the end of the day, any economic power is dependent on safe travel routes, trading routes, on open markets. So the interest of Germany and the European partners is to keep the trade with Asia ongoing. And for this reason, it's very important that we also look out for security challenges and tackle them. We see that this understanding somehow now sinks into the minds also of German policymakers. There's a very close cooperation between the German and the Australian government. We have a special working group between Australia and Germany, and we've seen that the Minister of Defence is currently in Australia, has very good talks from what I understood, and here we see that the security discussion ties into the economic sphere. We are not an active security actor in the region, but again, the realization that we have to do something to strengthen our partners in the region is something which is close to the heart of European and German policymakers.
Now, Germany also exists in its own geopolitical landscape in Europe and also very close to Eastern Europe, and we are seeing a lot of movement in that space as well with a resurgent Russia. How does Germany struggle to be able to apply its resources in numerous different geographical regions when it has its interests so globally spread?
It has its interests globally spread, but the main markets are now in Asia. I mean, for the past years, you could see that, for example, trade with the US has been the most important one, and now it's China. Companies looking out for other markets here in Asia and try to diversify their economic outlook, and they try to also deal with smaller states and have a lot of bilateral agreements. Now, because what we see, Germany has in the years after World War II been basically a mediator rather than an actor, and being in the middle of things changes the way you interact with other countries. So the danger is that we are squeezed between different power centers, and therefore it's very important that Germany reaches out to its allies and friends, most prominent among them Australia, and really finds way to also understand what to do in the difficult situation of having China as an ambitious new foreign policy actor, the United States of being something we can't really tell about what will happen in the future, also with respect to our close relationship and also with respect to Russia. So it's a very new set of questions we are faced with, but again, Germany has some experience of being in the middle of things and is now in the process of trying to, you know, figure out where it can replace its interests the best and where it can apply its strengths the best.
You mentioned how the US is changing its perspective in the way of its partnerships and its allies. What is the main feeling in Germany about the nature of the US leadership under Donald Trump and how that affects Germany's view and activity in the world?
Well, Germany distinguishes between the current administration and the long-standing relationship it has with the United States. The dependency on the United States is enormous, especially when it comes to security questions. So therefore, we can't even afford of really looking for an alternative, because all our security issues are dependent on the support of the U.S. So we have to continue to entertain a good working relationship with the U.S., but we are concerned that the support we had for so many years is fundamentally changing, and what is changing is the discourse, which is very hard right now, because again, Germany doesn't have an alternative. Therefore, I see efforts to reach out to other allies to strengthen also European integration, and reaching out to Australia and to France as their close allies is something we have seen with more intensity after the Trump administration took office.
Fantastic to speak to you here on the sidelines at the Women in National Security Conference. Dr. Nicole Renvert, thanks for speaking to us on the National Security Podcast.
Thank you very much.
That was Chris Farnham catching up with Nicole Renvert, Associate Fellow of the German Council on Foreign Relations. Keen to hear what participants were gaining from the conference, he also chatted to a few to see what was inspiring them, any particular issues that stood out and resounded with them.
Commodore Michelle Miller, welcome back to the National Security Podcast, and welcome to the second day of the Women in National Security Conference.
Terrific to be here. What a lineup of speakers there's been over the last couple of days. And even if it's not your area of direct interest, there's stuff in almost every presentation that's just great general education about the breadth of national security, but also some of the different perspectives. It's been terrific.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed Frances Adamson's speech. I think she connected to the crowd quite quickly, and with her references to Game of Thrones, she had a bit of a comical sense to it. And I think when you're sitting down all day, to have that kind of approach, is it stands out amongst all the speeches. So far that's probably been my favourite.
How did you enjoy the conference?
It was really good. I really enjoyed having that balance of discussing gender and women issues, and at the same time having general national security topics, but with a focus on female presenters. I think it was a good balance, and I think it worked really great.
And how did you enjoy the conference?
I particularly enjoyed hearing from the school students. I think it was really, really inspiring to hear from the next generation of leaders. And it was actually really inspirational to hear their stories and why they're eager to pursue a career in security.
And did you have any highlights from the conference?
I couldn't pick just one. I think every session was very different but equally important. And we all hope to come again next year.
Marina Serbus, welcome to the final day and the networking drinks of the Women in National Security Conference of 2018. Now, we just heard from Rory Medcalf, who is the head of the National Security College, and he mentioned that this has become the preeminent national security conference in Australia. How does that make you feel, being the inaugural convener of the Women in National Security Conferences?
I'm very pleased. I didn't think that would necessarily happen, but there's an element of if you build it, they will come. So I think it's just shown the convening power of women in national security.
So hi, I'm Sophie Tremere. I'm from TALIS, one of the sponsors. My thoughts on the conference are that there was some really excellent debate around the role of women in national security. Particularly, I think one of the best speakers was Frances from Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I thought she was incredibly engaging and would be an amazing leader to have at the helm of your organisation. Also, Mike Pezzullo from the Home Affairs, Secretary for Home Affairs. He was amazing, also very inspirational and really insightful in terms of what he talked about around the license that we have to act in this space. So not just doing things for the sake of like finding out what we can achieve, but actually operating within our license and respecting privacy. So those were my two highlights.
Now, how did you find the conference?
It was really great. Very informative, very entertaining. Time well spent.
So what were some of your takeaways from the conference?
So I found it really enriching to hear a wide range of perspectives on national security. I found the presentations today to be especially diverse, which I really liked. Like the presentation on the community from Cape York was especially enlightening, so really enjoyed that. It's one of the highlights.
We are about to meet Alia Huberman from the ANU, who has some thoughts for us.
I think this conference has been a really incredible showcase of female talent in the industry, particularly for people like myself who are still studying and on the cusp of the industry, to see how many women are actively shaping the future of this country in its most challenging half century yet. It's been really inspiring and I think really important for everyone to remember that this country is being shaped by women at the helm of its national security community, and that they're doing incredible work.
Now, if you could have involved something in this conference that wasn't involved this time, what would that be?
Maybe some more discussion around climate change, or maybe some guest speakers from Vanuatu or the other Pacific Islands who are here today.
This is Jason Brown, National Security for TALIS, and TALIS, of course, is heavily engaged with the college as one of the leading institutions building security for Australia.
What were some of the takeaways from the conference for you, Jason?
Well, I think the most important one is to have in one room some of the most talented women in Australia who are focusing on the security issues. It was an extraordinary thing to do. I went to last year's, it was a great conference. This one takes it to another level, the level of debate, the level of engagement from young folk at university through to the most senior leaders of our Defence Department, our intelligence agencies. It was a fantastic thing to see, and it should be a real eye-opener for the rest of the community, the talent we've got here.
Oh, here we go! I'm going to say that the access are like an idiot.
That was Chris Farnham getting insight into the thoughts of participants at the Women in National Security Conference. If you liked the sound of it, we hope to see you there next year. On top of that, while he was getting busy amongst the action, he lined up Dr. Hung Lee Tu for a podcast on the ground. Dr. Lee Tu is a senior analyst at ASPE Defence and Strategy Program. Prior to joining ASPE, she worked at the Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at ANU, Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, and the Institute of International Relations in Taiwan. Her research interests include multilateral security in Asia, foreign policy in post-socialist countries, as well as identity politics. Given her breadth and depth of experience, she is going to share with us the Southeast Asian perspective on the quadrilateral dialogue.
G'day, Hung Lee Tu. Welcome to the National Security Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We are on the sidelines of the Women in National Security Conference. You've just spoken on a panel which was discussing the Indo-Pacific, and we can now call that a fannel, which is the opposite to a mannel.
Yeah, it was a very good one, actually.
It was a great discussion, and we're here talking today about a paper that you've just released, and it's called Southeast Asian Perceptions on the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, commonly known as the Quad. You've published this with our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, commonly known as ASPI. So why don't you give us a quick overview of the question you're asking in this paper?
Yeah, in my recent research endeavours, I think a lot of questions that I've encountered was what are the region's reception of the Indo-Pacific concept and what are their views on the Quad? And I kept hearing sort of one response to that it was sort of disseminated widely, that ASEAN or ASEAN region is not very favorable of the Indo-Pacific concept nor of the Quad. So there was a lot of concern being raised that the Quad in particular would challenge ASEAN centrality, and that would actually contribute to the maybe failure or challenge the success of the Quad. But if I know anything about ASEAN, I know that there would be a variety of different views.
So just before you go any further, let's just identify that the Quad, Quadrilateral Dialogue, is a loose organisation of four countries. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe just quickly go over what the Quad is and how it came about before we talk about the way we see ASEAN and the way that ASEAN countries see the Quad?
Yeah, so Quadrilateral Security Dialogue is actually an informal initiative of the four countries, Australia, Japan, US, and India, to come to together to work on a variety of issues, but mostly I think people are associating this initiative with security domain cooperation, and it's in certain sort of initial stage, at least the Quad 2.0, as I called it, because it is not a new concept. It is a revival of the Quad since the meeting in last November. It's certainly still in a very initial stage, yet there's so much debate on it already. A lot of opinions and a lot of perception or misperception are being taking a center stage rather than what actually Quad is and how it is developing. So actually that motivated me to do the study, because I hear a lot of disseminated views that I actually, it's not that I agree or not, but I thought that they are giving only a certain angle of a view and they're not reflecting the region, which is very diverse and will have very diverse security interests and concerns as well. So ASEAN, as I said, it will not easily come to one view on any issue.
So your paper looked at the Southeast Asia's perceptions of the Quad. Can you give me an idea of what drove you to ask this question and the methodology you used to carry out this research?
Actually, it is important to state the motivation of the study, because I've heard numerous times how ASEAN feels being challenged or ASEAN centrality will be sidelined because of the Quad in numerous conversations, in dialogue venues, or even, you know, in media. But I didn't really find that in my conversations with interlocutors in the region. So I felt that it is the perception that has been really widely disseminated, including in Australia, has been quite skewed to reflect one or two views only. Just out of curiosity, I started to talk and ask questions about the Quad and the perception of different people in the region about the Quad, and I found out there's quite a variety of views, and even people who would first sentence might seem skeptical, if you continue the conversation, they'll give you a little bit more nuanced view. So that was actually motivation of my study, to show a case that ASEAN is a very diverse region, the national interests will be very diverse, and it is an evolving perception. Like each of the countries perception will change depending on how actually the Quad really develops. So to have a narrative that...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Quad Can't success because ASEAN think it is challenging. I thought it was not entirely accurate, and that's why I embarked in the study that combines both quantitative surveys as well as qualitative interviews to really kind of highlight what are in current minds in the regional thought leaders and policy makers in the region.
And so what were some of the thoughts? What did you find with your research?
Well, I thought it was very positive in Vietnam and Philippines. Malaysia was quite a classic hedger, which doesn't say no and doesn't say yes.
Very classic Malaysia.
Yeah. Indonesia was also quite a big chunk of Indonesian respondents. We're on the fence, and I should say that, you know, I can only talk about my collected respondents rather the country perspective. But I thought there is a lot of room, for Quad to be accepted in the region. And I tell you why. I think, the report, that I published will show you, in numbers, pie charts and a lot of figures, to support that argument. But I think, you know, on principle, Quad works to the stability of the regions, right? That's the purpose of maintaining stability, peace, and cooperation.
So is that another way of saying that the Quad balances China's growing influence in the region, or is it something different?
Yeah, and I'll get to that point, to China as well. And, you know, ASEAN's objective is also peace, stability and prosperity. So, you know, where is the contradiction? There is none, right? Like Ambassador Ong Keng Yong, who was the former ASEAN Secretary General, also said that as long as it is, you know, in accordance to the principles and norms under ASEAN Charter that all, you know, sign off, there's no reason why we should oppose it, right? And there are few views that are negative or skeptical about the Quad. That's because of, I think, misunderstanding or not correct way of defining what is Quad. So first of all, is the Quad a challenge because it's going to be another institution then that could compete with ASEAN? But in my view, I don't think that's what Quad is going to do at the moment, to institutionalize like another ASEAN form.
So do you think this is why General Mattis, the US Secretary of Defense, was so deliberate in mentioning ASEAN's centrality when he was presenting at the most recent Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore? Do you think that there is an understanding of how important ASEAN's centrality is to the countries of the region?
And I think your question touches my second point, which is of the misperception and confusion with the Quad and Indo-Pacific. General Mattis talked about Indo-Pacific at the Shangri-La. He sort of didn't really talk about the Quad until the Q&A, if I remember correctly. But I think that's actually what is really confusing for the actors in the people in the region, that the Quad and Indo-Pacific are being conflated. The Indo-Pacific in its design is supposed to be free, open, and inclusive. And as you said, US, both in terms of speeches and policy papers, have included ASEAN centrality in the narrative. And so is Australian as well. Whereas the Quad is mainly, you know, driven by four countries and the meeting among them. So for ASEAN not to understand really the difference between two, it will be understood at, you know, overlooking ASEAN or sidelining ASEAN or not including ASEAN when the matters of the region happen in the region. So I think it is very important to highlight that the danger of conflating the two. And that's also one of the motivation of my study. So in my survey, I did ask to find out what are some understandings, how does the Quad relate to the Indo-Pacific concept? And most popular answer was whether it is, integral, external from the Indo-Pacific, it is comprehensive to the Indo-Pacific concept. Interestingly, I think the highest response that the Quad is actually integral part of the Indo-Pacific came from Vietnam. So the understanding between the relationship with Quad and the Indo-Pacific was reflected among the Vietnamese respondents.
Why do you think the Vietnamese were so positive about the Quad in your study?
Well, I think there's no coincidence that the two most supportive responses that I've got from Vietnam and the Philippines, the Vietnamese and Filipino respondents, it's no coincidence that, you know, they have interest in balance in the regional security cooperation that could, you know, balance the power because of what's ongoing on in the South China Sea.
Mm. And did you find any respondents that were almost opposite from, say, the Philippines and the Vietnamese response, people or countries that weren't so keen on the Quad?
I think respondents from Singapore, as I said, were quite skeptical about the Quad relatively. I mean, relatively to other ASEAN respondents. But my guess, as I said earlier, it's because this year is Singaporean's ASEAN chairmanship. There's so much focus on ASEAN itself, for ASEAN being still the leading framework and the center of attention and also its relevance, that somehow justify that reluctance to, you know, spread attention to other issues. That's one of the explanations.
So looking at the Quad itself, what do you think is driving the formation of the Quad, and do you think there's any misconceptions about where the Quad comes from? Is it something to contain China, or is it just an organic element of a changing region itself?
So China was always, you know, a part of the debate in terms of Quad. Quad earlier, over 10 years ago, was always also about China's reaction to the Quad in the first place, that put it to the lethargy for almost a decade. So that's why I think, you know, managing perceptions and managing opinions and views must be accurate to really, you know, being able to drive regional initiative or, you know, tailor policies, right? Like, that's fair enough that, you know, obviously the Quad will draw attention of China's, but is that my survey found out that majority of respondents thought that is what it is necessarily.
So they're hoping for a balancing actor in the region to keep stability? Is that what you're saying?
I think for smaller and medium-sized actors, it is always better to have sort of balance and more actors involved than just one dominant actor. I think that's a natural thing. And China's, again, in conversation when we talk about the revival of the Quad, why do we need revival of the Quad? And some would argue that, you know, the conditions are even more calling for such a balance of power or another initiatives or calling other actors to be involved in the region. And I would agree with that, except for one thing that we need to clarify. I think a lot of resistant to the Quad idea or Indo-Pacific comes from misunderstanding what is containment effort or balance effort. I think that conceptual gap must be addressed because it's not like containment in terms of not allowing China to grow, but balance in terms of, you know, allowing the region to have a balance of power, allowing, you know, a certain stability, and that balance of power is somewhere that, you know, we are still working by the rules, by rules-based order, where, you know, growth of one nation doesn't mean at the expense of others.
Do you think with China's goals, whatever they may be, and with China's vision of the region, that anything that is made to, say, balance China's emergence into the region or to shape its activities to suit a certain rules-based order, that China will actually see that as containment. If China wishes to achieve goal A, but we tell it, well, you can have half of goal A, but also half of goal B, you don't think that China will see that as some kind of containment?
I'm sure that there are such views. I think there is... China's going through a very much engineered narrative domestically at the moment in terms of what is its rightful for it. I think there is a huge sense of injustice done to China at the moment, and everything, including, you know, international law that they've signed up to, UNCLOS and stuff, and arbitral tribunal ruling that we've seen reaction to is unfair to China, even though they chose not to participate in the process. And I'm sure, you know, there will be reasons to do, to build up such a narrative in China. But at the same time, I think, if there is no conversation on both sides, and there's no other efforts to respond to China's rise, China's ambition will only grow.
Which is interesting, getting back to ASEAN, one of the main reasons that ASEAN was formed was to give a certain regional resilience. This was during the Cold War, and a lot of the countries in ASEAN, the original countries, were concerned that they were going to be forced to take on policies not of their choosing, whether that be through pressure from the US, pressure from China, or pressure from Russia. So part of the rationale of forming ASEAN was to protect the integrity of the region and the political sovereignty of the region. And now we see the way that they react to the Quad is same, same, but different mm-hmm. than during the Cold War. They're looking to balance the region between two major partners. Funnily enough, two of the powers that were present during the Cold War again. Do you think that there are any echoes from Cold War ASEAN to today's new balance of power in the region, ASEAN?
I think, I think the predominant narrative in ASEAN, and this is rather not really contested, is that they don't want to choose sides, right? They want to be, that's actually principle of ASEAN, one of the principles, which is neutrality. And there will be different, you know, strategic considerations and choices, and the degree that each country would want to be aligned or non-aligned, and that's their choices individually. But overall, the general preference is, you know, not being pushed to choose, right? And I think that's perhaps, as you said, put it out, that is a trauma from the Cold War era, where, you know, smaller countries are pressed by the big players. The Quad, I really think it's early days, so we should not be also putting up that those are fixed views. The views will be, I think, evolving depending how the Quad develops and how the regional context develops. I think there is some need for a balance, but there is a cautious, a kind of slow it down, cautious reception in the region, because the region needs players to be involved, and it is actually also quite concerned about being left alone, because the narrative coming from the White House and Trump president in particular, that don't really match with the narrative of the Indo-Pacific strategy, right? Which is like, you know, involvement in the region, whereas Trump doesn't seem to be convincing everyone that he cares. He chose not to come to the summits later in November. So that sent some signals as well, right? So to convince the region about, you know, the commitment and that the Indo-Pacific is for real, that the Quad is going to happen. So it's going to take more efforts rather than just narratives. The region would want that to happen, to see that happen. But at the same time, they still have to work with China and realizing that, you know, there are huge shift in geopolitics at the moment, and everybody is a little bit anxious, some more or some less. To work with China despite this anxiety, as we see, for example, from the joint drills just happened a couple days ago, showcase that ASEAN needs to work with China despite all the concerns they have, but they also will work with other external actors who want to contribute to the larger interest of the collective.
Part of your answer there reminds me actually of a contribution that you actually made to a journal that I edit, the Security Challenges Journal, quick
right.
plug from a journal out there, where you mentioned it's also looking at Australia's relationship with ASEAN, and it can't just be a special summit, that there actually has to be real effort, real follow-through and real understanding mm-hmm. of the motivations of the region, what the region wants, and how we can become part of the regional architecture mm-hmm. and neighbourhood as well. I think it was a great submission that you made to the journal, and I encourage
Thank
everybody
you.
To read it. So as you've mentioned, Australia is one of the Quad countries. What do you think some of the main takeaways for Australian policymakers should be from your findings?
Yeah, so one of the reasons, as I said, I wanted to learn about what are the prevalent perceptions in the region about the Quad, and the purpose of the finding is to inform the policy, to carefully tailor policy to the existing views and perceptions, and how to address those negative or, for example, or misperceptions. So my recommendation is to actually acknowledge the nuances within the ASEAN region and work individually with certain countries with tailored policies, rather than treating the ASEAN as a whole. And we have one policy towards how to buy in ASEAN support or how to work with ASEAN just as a one policy. I think there need to be nuanced policies. As I said, there are some countries that are more supportive and some are more skeptical. So we will need different approaches to work with them individually. And my second recommendation is actually address those misperceptions, because, you know, learning from the past experience, misperception can really cause a lot of damage, or, you know, leaving a void for certain views to be disseminated and then therefore take over the narrative can be also dangerous. So acknowledge and really do an in-depth studies of what are the perceptions, and really acknowledge the nuances and work with those nuances, rather than letting the misperception take over. And I think from what I understand, that there's certain preference of, you know, more action, more objective, and rather than building narrative. But I think the two also need to go in parallel, because if you lack narrative, there will be just continuous lack of understanding, lack of clarity, and therefore very hard to, you know, we can't really talk about support or not support if people don't know what is it that you're talking about and what are your objectives. So I really recommend, clarifying that to the Quad members, but also to the wider region.
Yeah, that's a fantastic takeaway, and it's a fantastic piece of work that you've done. I really encourage our listeners to get out and listen to it. And I just want to say thank you very much, Huang Le Tu, for joining us on the sidelines of the Women in National Security Conference.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So that's it for this week. But keep an ear to your podcast devices, because while today was going to be our last episode, we have a bit of a special pod due for release on Monday. We'll be hearing from the panellists of one of the crowd favourite events of the conference. Security through community. Woodjal Woodjal security songlines. Make sure you look out for that on Monday, because it is a fascinating discussion. We are really keen to hear what you have thought about our Women in National Security Conference guests and any of the issues that we have discussed. You can get in touch with us by Facebook, where we are Asia Pacific Policy Society, on Twitter, where we are @appspolicyforum, or just flick us through an email, podcast@policyforum.net. I'm Gabrielle Knipe, and until Monday, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.